This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark, I'm joined here with Delicious Tacos. He's known as a blogger and a novelist, and his latest book was Savage Spear of the Unicorn, and that came out earlier this year. Delicious Tacos, it's great speaking with you.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It's always weird to hear myself introduced as Delicious Tacos.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous fake name. It's a ridiculous person to be. And it's always funny to hear someone else say it out loud, but thank you for having me.
And I'm also joined here with Matt Peggin.
What's up, Matt?
Good to be here. How's it going?
So I don't really know anything about y'all's podcast, except I tuned in for the last episode and you guys said nice things about me.
The Welbeck Show, right.
Very pleased, yes. You called me the California Welbeck, which is praise that I probably don't deserve, but I'll take it.
Yeah, well, Robert actually said I simped to you on the last podcast, but it seems like maybe it's paying off by getting
you. Yeah, it's working.
Yeah.
I never listen to podcasts, and not because they're bad or anything. I just have too much other horse shit to do. But, I heard a little bit of your last one. It sounded interesting. It's interesting to hear people talking about books and literature. Nobody thinks about that shit anymore. So it's nice to discuss something that isn't Donald Trump or... football, money.
Yeah, for sure. I find it's really good to do a lot of these more literary or artistic-oriented shows because you can talk about all the important stuff that, in theory, politics is supposed to address without all the baggage, which hopefully we'll have a conversation like that today because I think your work's a good example about it, too.
There's no need to be nervous because no one's listening to book podcasts. Like, nobody reads.
Can you give some like background information about your history in blogging before your first novel, your debut novel, Finally Some Good News, that came out in 2018? So were you a blogger prior to that?
Yeah, so my website is deliciousTacos.com. I still am a blogger. I'm probably the last person still doing it. I have my first book. So I started that blog in 2012. It's been almost, this is its ninth year, which is fucked up to think about. Before that, I had another blog that I did for about 5 years. My first book was called Hot Naked Tits. It was a little ebook that came out in 2015. My first collection was called The Pussy. I'm saying the names of these books so that the listeners will go buy them immediately.
That's actually the only one that, Matt's actually read most of your work. I've only read The Pussy, and I'm just starting that, so I read two chapters. The one where you're talking about, the one about teenagers, and then the one about wage slavery, those two chapters I've read.
There's a lot of chapters about fucking teenagers and wage slavery. That you're going to find that those are recurring themes in the book. Also, my most popular book is Finally Some Good News, which is my first novel. It's about the end of the world. My new book is Savage Spear of the Unicorn. But if people don't want to listen, buy 15 books at once, go to my website, deliciousTacos.com. The shit is free. You can get an idea of whether you like me or not and then figure it out from there before you cough up your hard-earned wage-slaving cash.
Although I saw earlier you are having a sale right now until Christmas, right? 60% off?
Yeah, that's right. So the Kindle books are $3 until Christmas.
Nice.
And I'm doing that because I want to hit a certain amount of books sold by the end of this year. And then after that, I'm not going to put them on sale for a long time. I'm done, like, shilling and pumping and obsessing over my book sales and my page views. And my
Twitter I bought the Pussy when you were doing the $1 sale.
$1 Pussy is always popular. I've sold many thousands of those $1 Pussies. It's cool to do, I guess. It would be nice if I could make a living from my books. I'm not doing that. But I make a decent amount of money from them. However, it's stressful to be one's own marketing department and have to constantly pump it on Twitter. I know people have to be getting sick of it because I'm putting them on sale constantly, begging people for retweets. And I think what I'd like to do for the next year is just concentrate on my new book that I'm working on and just let my sales go in the toilet. I do have a job that makes me money, so I'm going to let my job do the money and not stress so much over shilling $1 pussy.
So do you use do you self-publish these, or do you have a publisher?
Yeah, I don't think any publisher would publish my books. Maybe if I sell enough through self-publishing, but I just assumed when I started out that no publisher would touch me with a 10-foot pole. In retrospect, it was a good decision because you get to keep a lot more of the money when you self-publish. You also get to put your books out immediately. There's no long bureaucratic process. You also don't have to deal with an editor. Maybe I could use an editor, but I can't conceive of an editor that I would like to be fucking with my prose. So it's not very prestigious. I think I've said before, like, self-publishing is like having herpes. There's less and less of a stigma, but it's still a stigma. And so if Random House came calling, I would certainly take their call. But nobody buys books like mine. Books are for women in general. Like, every popular book has a pink cover and is about women living in New York. Or it's some genre shit. So if I were a publisher, I wouldn't sell my books either. So it works out.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's very much my impression is what you said. I mean, books are mostly marketed towards women, and if not women, then a certain kind of bourgeois liberal class of men. It's hyper-specific kind of what, especially fiction, is catered to. It's almost its own genre, and yeah, people coming out of MFA programs.
I picked up this book called, I forget what it's fucking called, Severance by Ling Ma, right? This is so this book came out the same time as my book, Finally Some Good News. It's also about the end of the world. It's also about an office worker that experiences the end of the world. And on the cover of this book, they had to squish it down into 6-point font for all the awards and acclaim that this book got from every prestigious jerk off on the planet, saying this is the great, you know, New Yorker, this is the greatest book of all time, New York Times, this is a work of genius, the apotheosis of brilliance, blah, 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 NPR. And it's got a pink cover, and it's by a woman. And I was excited to read it because I would always see it whenever Finally Some Good News would get back on the Amazon bestseller list, like, this book would always be beating it because it's so popular. And I thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to read a book that is like things that I think about all the time, but it's from a woman's perspective. It's going to be different. And obviously, it's a brilliant, great book because it got all these awards. And it's just, it's okay. It's a little prissy, and it's a slight bore, and it's, remember the movie Sideways?
Oh, yeah, about the
Paul Giamatti. Sideways was the most critically acclaimed film of all time. It's about an ugly, fat, bald nerd who's obsessed with something that nobody cares about and is very passionate about it. It's his journey as a bitter jerk-off to fall in love with a woman that's much more attractive than him and be valued for his stupid niche knowledge. And it's the most popular, you know, it's the most acclaimed film of all time because it's about what exactly every movie critic was at the time. And so this Ling Ma book is about exactly what every publishing person is, which is someone living a weaker version of the tiny furniture lifestyle, that Lena Dunham movie. Somebody living in Brooklyn, fucking a lot of guys, sort of semi cares about their boyfriend, has a job in publishing, for Christ's sake. And that's why it is cliquish, but at the same time, I'm not in a position to really judge because obviously, like, I'm just bitter that nobody's offering me a publishing deal. One of my favorite authors is Sam Pink. I don't know if you guys have read any Sam Pink, but he doesn't make a living off it. So a lot of his books are about his side jobs working as a banquet hall waiter in the fucking Michigan Upper Peninsula. And he sells a lot more books than me. His books are a lot better than mine. He has a back catalog of 20 of them, and he's enormously acclaimed, does interviews constantly, has people jerking him off constantly, and is the rare case where this said jerking off is justified. And he doesn't make a living off the fucking books. It's hard to do. But that's one of the reasons why books are still a legitimate art form a lot of the time. Because television had a few great series, but most of it is horseshit. Movies are mostly horseshit. And it's because you can make money doing those things, so it attracts the sort of people that want to make money. Books have no material reward on this earth. You might be remembered for them after you die, living, you know, having lived an impoverished, lonely, self-torturing life. So when people really have something to say, they often do so in a book.
Have you ever had any issues with censorship? And are you more, is it more, what's a greater concern, the obscenity-based censorship or political-based?
It's a good question. You know, I did password protect about 225 posts on my blog after I got doxxed at my work. So I've never had censorship where Twitter has suspended me or WordPress has suspended my blog or Amazon has stopped carrying my books. I'm sort of pre-censored. I just assumed that, you know, that's the reason that I'm anonymous. That's the reason that I don't show face, is because even though the things that I say are not evil, they certainly make me unemployable in any respectable industry forever if people know my real name and my face and can associate it with my work. So have I been censored? No, but I mean, I've password protected a bunch of posts, and I'm anonymous. I don't show my face. If I was going by my real name, could I say the things that I say? Maybe. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, someday we'll fucking find out, because it is weird to keep calling myself Delicious Tacos.
Yeah, like a guilt by association. Like, it's like all that nonsense leads to a misinterpretation of people based on who they're associated with.
Sure.
And the thing is, like, you're not at all like right wing. You would say like relatively moderate to liberal. You did support like Bernie Sanders. And
I was a Sanders supporter, yeah.
Yes,
but I also
how, I mean,
like,
how would you
I
broadly,
also like guns.
Are they maybe so, call you like a Bernie bro, but how would you kind of broadly present yourself to like normies?
Okay, I don't give a fuck about politics at all. So my beliefs themselves are very extreme in the directions that they point, but the degree to which I'm passionate about those beliefs is essentially zero. So I would like to see a greatly expanded welfare state. I believe in gun rights. I believe that most things should be legal. Prostitution and drugs should be legal, and prostitution should in fact be encouraged and perhaps in some cases mandated. But I don't really care. Like, I've given up hope that society is going to get any better. I think America is a place that ultimately economically doesn't give a shit about its citizens, and to some extent, nor should it, because its citizens are fat bums. So I think society is going to do what it's going to do. It's like complaining about the weather, or it's like being people are really into Trump the way they're really into sports.
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
Out here where I am, so there, I have this thing. So a lot of right-wing people that, you know, are my friends online, a lot of very far right-wing people, including people with really, you know, the people that are the that hold the beliefs that people are, you know, that the media is actually paranoid about. And then people that I know in real life are super, super, they're not super liberal politically, but they're super anti-Trump. They're super, just anything Trump does causes them to get the vapors. And they can never admit that he's ever done anything good. And they're, you know, they're, it's orange man bad. I mean, it's, look, it's boring to even talk about the opposition to Trump. I'm really looking forward to his being gone, not because he's done a bad job as president or really done anything as president, but because I'm fucking tired of hearing about it. I'm tired of hearing about it from both sides. Look, a lot of my family is into Trump, and then a lot of my family is super liberal. So I love and respect people that hold both sets of beliefs. It doesn't really matter. And if shit really hits the fan, I'm moving in with my Trump-supporting cousin, and we're going to fucking have a compound.
But how big of a theme is economics, wage slavery, and a critique of capitalism in your work?
Well, is it a critique of capitalism? That sounds too nerdy and prissy to me. I hate working, and I've worked like a dog since I was 14 years old, with most of that time with very little to show for it. So I resent working, and I resent fucking having to work. I was cleaning toilets while I was going to fancy prep school. It made me sick, and you know, it still makes me sick to think about now. Is it a critique of the system? I don't know that a better system is possible. I also now have a bunch of money, so I don't want capitalism to collapse. Now I think the system is great, and I hope that the poor continue to suffer so that my stocks can increase.
Yeah, you were talking about how it's impossible to make a living as a writer. What kind of economic... Do you have any thoughts on overall, like, the economics of the arts and how the system works? And I don't know if you have a solution.
We're in the podcast era now, so people are doing these subscription podcasts and making tons of money. I do think that literature is probably suffering. You guys are doing it, you know, I'm sure a fine podcast, but in general, like, people who would be or who might be writing and blogging are instead doing podcasts because they're much more popular, they make a lot more money. And I think we're losing some literacy from the scene because of that. I also, you know, but people make tons of money because, and here's why, it's because it's like, remember, I don't know how old you guys are, but when I was a kid, there were ads in the back of magazines for get 10 records for a penny. It was like the Atlantic Records Club. And get like a Led Zeppelin record and a bunch of other shit for a penny. And the reason for that is because then you're locked into some subscription where you're getting charged $10 a month in perpetuity to get to receive fucking Grand Funk Railroad's, you know, collected B-sides. And that's what these subscription podcasts are. Like, it's just that it's people making money off people forgetting to cancel their subscriptions.
Well, not even just podcasts, but even like Spotify and streaming services. That's kind of a big part of the way people consume art and media is through this subscription, you know, pay X amount and have, you know, and have everything for a month, and then you just got to keep paying.
Yeah,
it kind of seems like that's the economic direction it's
going. That was one of the most common questions I used to get. So I would get two questions. Number one is, why don't you write XYZ? XYZ being horror, erotica. Why don't you write a real, you know, or some manosphere horseshit? And it's because I can't write things that I don't believe. And then the other thing that people would ask me is, why don't you do a podcast? And it's because I'm not especially good at it, and I don't have a lot to say in this format. I enjoy writing. You know, look, the audience can judge for themselves, but listen to me. I sound like a fucking dork, and I'm not the kind of person that can carry a whole conversation. The podcasts that I'm on really depend on the host and the questions that the host asks. And so for me to talk blankly into a microphone for a certain amount of time and charge people money for it just doesn't appeal to me. But if I get fired from my job, we'll see.
So we're all, like, all three of us are based in California, and you live in L.A., and how long have you lived in L.A.? What drew you to the city, and what do you think about people in kind of our political sphere who always like to kind of, trash California? Yeah. What initially drew you here?
Yeah, so people trash California because they think that I somehow support Gavin Newsom, who's a disgusting imp. I don't want to say, like, if I said my true feelings about Gavin Newsom, I would be arrested. California is not its politics, and it's a geographically beautiful place. It's an ethnically diverse place in the best way. It's obviously the weather is fucking gorgeous, and I know that's a cliche to say, but when I was in Thailand experiencing monsoons, I was in, you know, tropical paradises, and you get depressed because it's fucking cloudy all the time. You're in a tropical paradise and it's fucking cloudy constantly. It's beautiful, it's sunny, people are nice, the women are very difficult. California probably has the worst women in the world, and, you know, generally, but just the natural beauty here is amazing. The wildlife is amazing. The birds are amazing. It's also staggeringly expensive. A house in my neighborhood costs about $700,000 or $800,000. Back when I was looking at buying a house, the interest rates were, mortgage interest rates were 4.5%.
Yeah, even in the ghetto parts of LA, like, everything starts at $500,000.
Yes. Then that's partly because African American people have been driven out of LA, and those areas are all Mexican now, so people are less scared of black people and want to go gentrify it. And so those houses are $500,000 bucks. And then again, if you're paying 4.5% interest, I understand that it's lower now, but at that time when I was looking, a 30-year loan, you borrow $500,000 and you're paying back that plus $450,000 in interest. It's absurd, and you think that it's unsustainable. You keep waiting for it to crash. The whole city is a homeless encampment. It looks like fucking Thunderdome out there. I don't happen to be scared of it. I'm not scared of homeless people, but a few hundred yards from my house, there's encampments and tents and crazy meth heads with, for some reason, 10 bicycles and 15 laptops in their tent, and it's crazy, but it's just fun, and it's a significant place. It's a culturally meaningful place. It looks like where all the movies are. It's where Charles Bukowski was. It's where Raymond Chandler was. It's an important and significant place. I also like that it's not New York, so it's significant enough, but you can still be close to birds, nature, and wildlife here. So LA is a beautiful place. However, I'm 44 years old. My sperm is probably already defective. I may never get married and may never have kids because I lived in LA so long, because it's really impossible to do here. And it's because, again, the women here are mostly subhuman garbage.
The economic issues you're talking about definitely don't make it easy to have kids or a family. I mean, we all have very similar thoughts. I think despite all the issues, and a lot of them are economic in terms of being able to buy a house and stuff, it is always an interesting place to live. And yeah, it's not New York. I've been pretty happy here.
I'm looking at the sunset out my window right now over a mountain, beautiful trees waving. It's December. It was 65 degrees out today. Beautiful birds in my yard. I'm happy. If I can go somewhere and there's nice birds to look at, I'm happy.
Oh, yeah, you are an avid bird watcher.
That's right.
Is it just sort of specifically like studying birds, or you just enjoy nature in general?
I like nature in general, and the thing about bird watching is that you can't always go somewhere and see an elk, right? You can't always go somewhere and see a wolf, but wherever you are on this planet, there are beautiful, interesting birds right near you, right outside your window to look at, doing interesting things. So that's true in New York City. That's certainly true in LA.
What have you noticed as like the recent trends? Like, you talk about the homeless, and as far as like post-COVID, like there's this talk of a massive exodus out of LA, out of California. Have you really been noticing a dramatic change after COVID,
not at
or is
all.
It overblown?
There's no exodus out of LA. There's an exodus out of San Francisco, which really, which certainly deserves an exodus. LA, I have not seen home prices going down at all. So there's not a lack of demand for homes. I think that's partially because it's, 2% interest rates now, but people aren't leaving LA. LA is not a company town. People think it's a show business town, which it kind of is, but there's the fucking two giant ports here. So it's never going to economically shut down. This is where goods come from Asia. They arrive in Los Angeles. So, and there's always tons of people immigrating here from Mexico. There's not enough space for everybody still. And obviously, as evidenced by the fact that people live in tents instead of choosing to leave and go somewhere else. They live in Coleman pup tents along the river and along the freeway because it's just nice and easy to live here.
You said if they do leave, it's more likely to Orange County than out of the state altogether.
I think that's speculation, I think, because I used to live in Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh was a booming steel town, and then the urban center sort of collapsed into a sort of stereotypical urban center, and there was this ring of suburbs. I had a job going door-to-door soliciting political donations for left-wing groups. So we would go out to these suburbs that were always named after an animal. It'd be like Raccoon Township, Fox Chapel, all these places. And wealthy sort of prosperous Republican square-jawed men whose ancestors used to work in the steel industry moved out to these little towns ringing around the city, and they sent their kids to nice schools. It was white people, and it looked like 1950s America out there, and maybe the same thing will happen with LA.
Yeah, you have it a little bit. I would say Valencia, if you've been there near Santa Clarita, has a little bit of that vibe. It's a very kind of white and old-time.
Santa Clarita area, like Thousand Oaks and Ventura County, and then Orange
also
County too.
Empire.
Yeah,
The other place I could see getting a huge wave of people, if whatever happens, would be just... It already is happening. Inland Empire is already one of the fastest growing.
But the thing is, Inland Empire is kind of looked down upon as kind of pro.
And, yeah, what does it have to recommend? I mean, Inland Empire is a cheaper place to go if you work in Los Angeles. I've spent a lot of time there, and I like it out there, but, yeah, it is kind of a shithole.
Oh, yeah, like, we took a road trip to the Mojave Desert and Death Valley, and we had dinner in Claremont, which is a college town, which is, like, the one kind of swipple upscale part of the Inland Empire.
Were you checking out the Claremont Institute? were you there?
No,
to visit
we were just there briefly for dinner, and it was pretty deserted.
Yeah, I used to work out there. I would take the train to work out there. It's a fascinating place. That's where all the African American people went that got booted out of Compton by Mexicans.
Oh, no, Claremont is upscale. You're probably thinking of Palmdale.
Yeah, not Claremont in particular, but I mean the Inland Empire.
Yeah, Inland Empire
like
in general.
Ontario, Rancho,
oh, yeah.
Cucamonga,
like
Redlands,
and then way out, like as far out as like places like Victorville in the desert.
Yeah.
So as far Boondocks. As like the groups, the demographic groups you've socialized with, and the women in LA you've dated, are you exposed to basically all groups, or is it one particular like demographic niche in LA?
I fuck them all.
Oh yeah. What is your like? What would your general general assessment be?
Of Los Angeles women, I mean, it used to be great. Now it's awful, and it's hard to tell if that's because I'm 44 years old and I'm a lecherous old man trying to date younger women. But I really do think that whatever covenant there was between men and women in civilization is gone, and we are in a pussy warlord period.
Well, here's a question then. In terms of that. Because we did have that in the notes to talk about that notion as a theme that's both in your and Welbeck's work.
Yes.
As great as LA is, and I really do like living here, would you say, is there an element to which, in as far as there is a lack of covenant between the sexes, is LA kind of at the forefront of that?
I believe that Los Angeles is now the worst pussy city in the world, worse than San Francisco. I've not been to Toronto, and I say this with a large blind spot, but it is genuinely impossible now to have a relationship in Los Angeles. And again, I can only speak, I understand that I sound like, and probably rightly, like a bitter old spinster, because that's exactly what I am. But that's my experience now. It used to be very easy to date here, and even then people would complain that it was hard when I was having a very easy time, and now I'm having a very, very hard time.
Like, there was a big change in the 2010s, like when Tinder took off.
Yeah, they call LA Los Angeles. The LA bars always had nothing but men. I mean, it's always been a tough town. There's the stereotype of it being... Everywhere I've gone, you know, I used to work in Hollywood. I was in development. I was working for a production company, and people were like, oh, you must get so much pussy. No, I don't get pussy doing that. I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. People were like, oh, man, you must get so much pussy. No, I don't get any pussy there. It's harder than you think. Maybe it's just because I'm not a naturally charming person when I'm not drinking. But it's, you know, who knows? There's too many confounding factors for me to know what's what. I'm sure probably younger men are having a great time.
There's some, like, thing I'm hearing around from on Twitter from these kind of, like, from incel types that there's going to be an economic collapse, and that's going to kind of change things as far
that
as
was
we were talking
my,
about.
Was,
yeah,
the
I've
the heard price that. The price of pussy is tied to the Dow Jones and real estate market. So we need an economic depression to end the pussy depression. Who the fuck knows if that's true or not? I just know that I talk to women a lot, and look, I love all the women I talk to, but some of them aren't exactly, we're not talking about tens here, and they have tons and tons and tons of men nakedly pestering them, not just for sex, but for videos, for love, for conversation, for the cock of an eyebrow. Every woman I know has tons and tons of men chasing after her, and has tons of stories about everywhere they go, convenience store clerks hitting on them, everywhere they fucking go. And it's over, man. I feel like there's 100 men to every woman in this town. And who knows? But again, I like it. I don't mean to trash it. I like it a lot here, and that's the one drawback. So the expense, which is manageable now because I make a lot of money, and the women, which are, you know, again, I'm 44 years old. I'm not good looking. I'm a weirdo who writes self-published books called The Pussy. I don't drink. I go to bed at 9:30 p.m. I'm not rich, and I don't live in a happening spot. So all those things might explain why I'm having a hard time.
Well, I don't want to self-dox here too much. Well, I go under my real name, so maybe that's why I don't want to say too much. But I'll say that I'm 25, and my experience is largely similar. I've actually been in a long-term relationship now for a few years, so that's been great. But when I first moved here and the Tinder scene, and just, as you said, what I hear from the women that I know about the way that they have men badgering them online, et cetera, and this sense of there being 100 men to every woman, completely checks out with me, even from a different perspective. So I think it's definitely a very real force in the city.
It's shockingly bad. And that's a very important aspect of life. Your romantic life is an important aspect of your life. So for it to be crippled is not healthy.
Yeah, you use like this talk of like geomaxing or cmaxing, as some call it. Like, you've traveled the world. Like, if you had to rank the places you've been, so you put LA towards the bottom, and then which places you've been towards the top? Is it mostly?
Southeast Asia.
Oh yeah.
So that's put, you know, the pussy capital of the planet, the best pussy, the most pussy, the nicest pussy, the pussy that likes you the best, is in Southeast Asia, and particularly the Philippines.
I know Matt Forney agrees.
I'll say this every time. There's never been a stronger co-brand of man in country than Matt Forney in the Philippines. And I write a lot about the Philippines.
Well, he wrote a book about it.
Yeah, people constantly, every time I mention the Philippines, people are like, Forney was there. Yes, okay. Well, there you have it. I mean, that's a point that he and I agree on. It's very easy to get laid in the Philippines.
Yeah, the Southeast Asia. Have you been, how well have you traveled? Have you been to Northeast Asia, Australia, South America, Europe?
No, I've been to Japan, which was very nice, but didn't slay any ass there. I was there very briefly. I've been to Peru. I've been to Mexico a few times, and that's about it. So, and then in Southeast Asia, I've been to Thailand, Philippines, and Cambodia. Peru is not a pussy-getting country either, or at least, you know, Cuzco. And I was there to do touristy shit. I went to Machu Picchu, and I went to the rainforest and stuff. So I wasn't there to get pussy, and it's good because most places where I've been, where I'm, you know, 6'1", blue eyes, long-nosed white man, people do look at you, girls do check you out on the street. Not in Peru. They're very proud people, and so they are not like, you know, hoes like Colombian women or something.
What about Mexico?
Mexico's all right. You know, again, nobody was checking me out in Mexico either. I've been in touristy places. I was in Mexico City. I was in, you know, I've been to Tijuana a couple times, and then I've been to Quintana Roo and the cities there. I've been to, you know, Tulum and Playa del Carmen. And I didn't get laid there either, so.
Yeah, it does seem that you see this kind of, like, fusion of, well, it used to be more that you had, like, a left that was more libertine. And sure. This fusion of, like, wokeness, woke puritanism with social conservatism. And there's this big thing now, like, there's a, like, shaming large age gaps, like, age gap hysteria.
Well, look, they're not exactly wrong. When I'm fucking an impoverished 19-year-old in the Philippines for $6, is that something that should be smiled upon by society? Probably not. I probably deserve their opprobrium. And I say, like, look, young women are hotter than older women. I'm sure young guys are hotter than older guys too, but that's somebody else's job to decide.
Oh yeah,
However, as Patrice O'Neill said, an ugly 19-year-old is better looking than a good-looking 35-year-old.
It's actually, you talk about younger men being more attractive. It's way more accepted in the gay community. But yeah.
Whatever. I'm not one of these guys that's going to say, I don't need to morally defend my own horniness. Like, I fuck much younger women because I'm a disgusting, horny person, not because, you know, oh, it's normal and traditional in many societies. Don't, you know, who cares? I don't give a fuck what people think. And I'm not on some crusade to justify my own perversions. Like, I just like to fuck teenagers. Sorry. Like, I do. It's, and I do, it's biological. It's a, look, it's a biological truth, but so is the desire to commit murder, and that's not right either. So I understand that there's some, you know, look, maybe what I'm doing is disgusting and wrong. I'm not fucking any underage people when I go to these countries, because I certainly don't want to fucking end up in a Gary Glitter tiger cage in some Southeast Asian country. But, you know, am I, but 19 to 22 year olds, absolutely.
Yeah, well, I don't see your work as in any kind of moral crusade to defend that. What I see it as is, you know, addressing and actually talking about something that a lot of people experience, that kind of attraction or what have you, and a lot of people actually participate in, and what your work does is actually talk about it.
Teenage girls are about 1,000 times hotter than older women, and everybody knows it.
It's one of those things everyone knows them privately, but you can't say it in polite society.
Now, it doesn't mean, look, I love age-appropriate women and they're beautiful, blah, 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 and I get, you know, I would want to have a relationship with somebody that is appropriate for my own age. However, just in terms of raw physical attraction, sorry, like, teenage girls are just hot, and everybody fucking knows it, sure.
What's interesting is looking at these kind of, like, generational tropes. So it seems that, like, there's one trope of a Gen Xer who's in his 40s and 50s and was successful in life early on, and now they're kind of at a stage where they feel washed out. And then with the millennials, the trope is more, I don't know, like the incels is kind of a stereotypical millennial trope.
I wonder what's going on with younger guys, man. All I see is the despair and almost like justified misogyny that they feel in the way that women are treating them. I just wonder how much of it is real.
Yeah,
well, there's got to be somebody's getting pussy out there, right?
Somebody. I mean,
even if it's one guy.
I'm the younger person in the room here. I mean, what was I going to say? Like, I don't. There's just so many factors as to why it's so hard for millennials and younger in my generation. Not even just to get laid, but to, you know, have fulfilling relationships, start families. I mean, obviously, if we look at the stats, we know all these things are in an incredible decline. And it's, you know, some people would say it's the porn.
With sex, but also, like, fertility rates are at the lowest. But suicide rates, depression, addiction are increasing, and that's just getting worse during the pandemic, but it was already pretty bad.
It's like they're all different parts of the elephant, you know, the old metaphor about the blind men of the elephant, right?
Here's what I want to tell people, though. So I get inundated with this kind of depressing bad news all the time, and I'm guilty of spreading it, and in fact, I'm guilty of spreading it earlier in this conversation, like, no one's ever going to get laid, like, women are terrible, nobody ever gets married, nobody has kids. Forget all of that, because that's all just politics, too. It's all just society. You, as an individual, don't have to experience that. There is still hope, and there is still a way. You can still have a fulfilling life, and so don't get too bogged down. And one of the things, I write about a lot of depressing shit, but my work is not meant to be depressing, and it's not meant to make people feel hopeless. It's meant to point out shared frustrations and use a sense of humor while doing so. So it's not black pill. There is beauty in the world, and it's possible. It's hard. Look, I know it's frustrating to be alone, but if it's really a problem, once this pandemic is over, get on a plane somewhere, and there are plenty of wonderful women in the world that would be happy to be with you.
Yeah. No, I think that really comes through in your work. I mean, if books that are just black pills, you know, literature has levels, and yours really goes there in terms of the vacillation between these two sides of life.
Have you read Michelle Welbeck's book Platform about geomaxing?
So Platform was one of the books that I reread before I wrote Finally Some Good News. Because he obviously has, you know, a lot of Finally Some Good News takes place in Southeast Asia and deals with the Southeast Asian sex trade. And obviously Platform does as well. And I love all of Welbeck's books. I've read all of them, a few times. He's one of the, I think he's the greatest living writer. And Platform, I think, I always read him for tone. I think I took it a little farther with my, you know, chapters on fucking hookers. I was disappointed in him for using a condom with his tie hooker and when he finally fucks one. And his is more sort of a, he's more open about sort of his philosophical message or his, you know, economic thoughts in that book. I'm looking more at the emotional weight of it. And my sex trafficking chapter specifically is about how the character goes to the Philippines thinking he's just going to fuck a lot of whores. And then he sees all the other old white men there who are just drained and miserable, which is true. When you go, you know, you think you're going to go and like, I'm going to go to Pussy Paradise and live in the jungle and fuck, you know, these girls that live in huts. And then you see, you know, the girls themselves, and you think what you're going to see is like these horrible victimized girls. The girls are actually happy. They're making tons of money. They don't, you know, they're not. They're
Oh, so the guys are, they seem depressed.
The guys are completely miserable. They're not taking any joy in it.
Are these just the Americans, or have you talked to, like, the Japanese or Australians?
I've not talked to a lot of the Asian guys. The Australians are so horny. So Southeast Asia is the Tijuana of Australia. Australian men are so horny, they put me to shame. So the younger Australian guys are cool to hang out with. The older guys just sit there, like, they have strip club eyes on wherever they go. Just these grim thousand-yard stare faces everywhere you go. And you want to just be like, hey, man, we're about to go get some pussy. Like, we're about to go to a whorehouse. Isn't this fun? And they just look very intent, like it's their job. Like, they're clocking in at the office to fuck today's catamite. It's really sad.
Experience? That was your experience in the in Thailand?
I always have fun. I love the girls. I love talking to them. They're fascinating people with incredible senses of humor, great life stories, and I'm a treat for them because I'm not 120 years old, so I still look pretty good. If they have to fuck somebody for money, I'm not such a bad choice.
But that's what you noticed amongst the other people there.
The other guys, yeah.
I see. Because in Welbeck, in Platform, Welbeck seemed. I'm trying to remember. He does say that there is something of a grim sort of demeanor, yes, among some of them, but there's also the most memorable part of that book for me. Well, it's very memorable in general, but probably the most memorable scene is a description of like an old German guy getting a lap dance, and the Welbeck character, the main character, says something like, "It was with great sadness that I realized this was probably the last happy moment of his life," or something.
My favorite scene in that book is when they fuck their maid in Cuba. I don't know why.
Oh yeah.
Although he uses condoms there too. It's just horrific. How could you? You know.
Is there some kind of like French censorship that he's looking to dodge there? Probably not. But
can you talk about your work in Hollywood and both as an assistant and adjacent to social media marketing? And sure. One of the interesting things that you figured out is that everything is created by the economic 1% who are paid to do so. And you kind of mm-hmm. touched on that in the beginning, and the rest of us are just employed in selling it. And a version Correct. Of it's probably true just about everywhere and always, but it's especially yeah. felt in a supposedly creative city like LA. The struggle that you would describe as a very demanding as a selling other people's creativity, trying to make time for your own creativity, and also relates to the theme of work as a slave morality.
Well, first let me interject with another great thing about LA, which is that nobody shits on your dream here. So I can go around occasionally and tell people like, hey, I'm a I have this day job X, Y, and Z, but I'm also a self-published novelist. My books are doing pretty well. And people aren't like, oh, you fucking idiot. That's stupid. They're like, oh my God, that's so great. You know, if you tell people that you want to be a great trombone player here, people will respect your dream and encourage it. So that's a beautiful thing about LA. I worked in Hollywood for 9 years. I did the what's called the development track. So I moved here with a girl. I moved here with my ex-fiance, RIP to her. And I wanted to get a cool job, and I was working here, and I wanted to be a writer. So I thought I wanted to be a screenwriter. Now, I've never written like word one of a screenplay. But I got an internship working at a production company, and then I worked at an agency desk, and I did So in Hollywood, to become a producer or to become a studio executive or whatever, you have to start out doing these long slogs answering phones at an agency.
This is just kind of hypothetical, or could just how like our economic system functions and the culture too. But would ideally, would there be some kind of UBI for qualified artists and bloggers?
I think that the government should give me money. Look, America is an economically right-wing society. There is never going to be a welfare state that helps men, that helps young men who should be out there busting their humps.
There's a sort of a niche welfare state with like single moms, but there's not a broader welfare state like a strong UBI that benefits everyone.
That's right, and I don't think there ever will be. But who knows? Again, I can't place any bets on the future of our society. I would love for there to be a UBI. Can we afford it? Who knows? I think there's too many. Like every time you mention any expansion of the welfare state, people are such passionate nerds about their right-wing economic beliefs. Like people really, really believe in Ayn Rand shit like a religion. They're zealots about it.
I think to some degree, like an economic collapse is a cope, and we could very well just get a continuation, like what Welbeck said, that it'll just be the same and shittier, more continuation of like trends of just a shittier society, more income inequality. But I do think like a hard economic collapse would wake up people economically.
The way that feminists would be strapping explosive vests to themselves if there was some kind of government program to give men pussy. Right-wing economic nerds would literally commit suicide bombings to protect Ayn Rand capitalism.
Like, it's not, like, practical, but ideally, like, immigration policy should favor, like, young women.
Absolutely. We should be importing, wife material. Absolutely. We should, we should definitely have a pipeline from the Philippines, Colombia, and I'm not even kidding here. It would make the country much happier, as it would put American women spiritually better in their place. It would get rid of the incel problem. The men would have to clean themselves up to actually be presentable to a goddamn woman instead of giving up. It would be better in every way. And plus, it would spite other countries. It would be great.
That plus the UBI. If someone were to run for office,
neither of those things is ever happening. For the young men that are out there, a thing that I wish I had done now that I'm in my old age is, for all my leftist economic views that I pushed for and pushed for and pushed for, it was all horseshit. It's not ever going to happen in our lifetimes. So start prudently saving and investing some money now in your youth. Get as much money as you can, and retire as early as possible. That is my advice to young people.
Yeah, it's personal advice. That's good advice. And then probably, but as far as policy, we'll probably end up with like woke austerity.
There's no, who cares? Like the federal government doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, but that's the thing, is like you have to kind of carve out your own path with yourself or a group of people. Like you can't. It's just psychologically unhealthy to be so emotionally invested in politics.
City parking regulations are a lot more meaningful than anything passed by the United States Senate.
Yeah. But I guess, okay, I do want to say this about Hollywood. I mean, again, we don't necessarily need to talk about that much. I'm just curious because I've listened to some of your other interviews and obviously read your work where you've talked about this. What you've ended up doing in life is kind of taking the path where your creativity and the way you earn money are entirely separate spheres, which in the long run probably is the healthier route, probably is what I'll end up doing. In the short term, I'm still kind of trying, however, to fight the uphill battle, so to speak.
What are you doing?
Well, I still have some aspirations in, the screenwriting direction.
Okay. That's a fucking hard road, man.
Yeah.
Write the book first. Write the book first and do it your way, and then figure out the screenplay after.
Funny you should say. Give me an opportunity to shill here. And Robert and I both did want to do this before.
Yeah, we both have. Matt has his debut book coming up in early next year, and I also have the sequel to my first book coming up soon. And the sequel to my first book, it takes place in California. It has Welbeckian themes, like similar themes to your work. And I don't want to give away the plot, but it's more The writing styles, I mean, the writing style is a bit different, but it's a surreal dark comedy.
Right on.
Yeah, then mine is coming out with on Matt Forney's press, actually, Terror House.
Nice. And yeah, he's done a great job. Matt Forney is an interesting cat because he's been around longer than me, and he's about 15 years younger than me. And he's reinvented himself 10 times since I've known of him. And this new, I think he's found his groove, tapping into publishing people's books. Right?
I mean, it's great what he's doing.
Putting out good shit.
Yeah, it's great. He's with Terror House. Yeah, I think it's the first one. Like, he's been relatively successful, and he's also providing a platform for a lot of these like excellent under the radar writers.
Yeah, and
I wonder how he's doing.
You know,
I mean, I wonder how those books are selling. I wonder if he, you know, who knows? Because the economics of book sales are not great. He works with Matt Lawrence, who is the graphic designer who worked on all my books. I think he also works with Owen Cyclops, who drew the unicorn for my latest book. So he's working with a lot of people that I like and respect, and it's great news. But I don't read a lot of people's self-published books either, because I only want to read shit that's better than me. You know, I want to read shit that I can aspire to. Not to say that, I don't know, you know, these books could be great, but like, I'm older than these guys. So I think that, you know, I need to read books by either Michelle Houellebecq or some dead people to serve as an intermediary between them and the next class.
I get what you mean for sure. I mean, I don't read a ton of self-published books. I try to, because I want to be supportive to other people who are trying to do what I'm trying to do. Yeah. So there's that element. There's like, you know, doing it out of a sense of obligation or something. But I'm not trying to flatter you here, but I think what I always said about your books when I was trying to get other people to read them. Now, I only got into your work about a year ago. Right. It feels like longer, but I've tried to read a lot of like books that have come out of Twitter, and like most of them, frankly, aren't very good. But I do think your work really transcends the medium.
I agree. My shit is good. Thank you. I don't want to jack myself off, but I work really hard on it, and I've been doing it for a long time, and I work hard to make it the best that I can. There's not a lot that's sloppy or impulsive about what I put out, and I do try to not identify too strongly with any given scene or any given moment, because I'm trying to do something that is, I was about to say for the ages, which sounds like a complete jerk off, but I'm trying to create like real legitimate books. I'm doing my best. Now there is some amateurish shit about them, but you're walking a fine line first, because you got to be who you are. And a lot of so-called real books are prissy and boring and tame. So I think the ideal book is something that is exciting and horny and has real emotion in it, but still the person has taken the time to develop their skills as a writer, so that the most important, people's ideas don't matter at all. Nobody really has any good or new ideas. People's prose ability matters 100%. And most of the stuff that I read, like, if you don't have a good first sentence, suck my dick. You owe it to the reader to absolutely kill with your first sentence. Now, I'm not saying it has to be, you know, you have to want to read the second sentence, right? Your last sentence also has to be perfect. You have to perfect your last sentence. And then you need one beat in the middle at the end of Act Two that has to be perfect. And if you can get those three things, then you're pretty much there. However, a lot of the shit I read has a really boring first sentence that's just really expository, setting shit up, is trusting me to have patience to read through an entire paragraph, which nobody has. You have to create a little suspense. So, post office, Charles Bukowski's post office, it began as a mistake. That's the first sentence. What? That's an example, right?
I'm pretty sure what you're saying is exactly what they try to teach in MFA programs, too. That basic notion. So you're saving all of Robert's listeners money on an MFA. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is what you're describing is the basic building blocks of a good story, and it's really not that complicated. You just have to learn how to do it.
That is something that I really learned in Hollywood. I needed a structure, and I learned story structure a lot in Hollywood from taking scripts apart and putting them back together. And
it could be the worst. It could be the worst like animated kids movie ever, but structure is pretty. And of course, you know, it's all well and good to be experimental and go off of whatever, but like. Basically, the basics of structure have nothing to do with the quality of the story overall. It's kind of a mechanical thing you have to overlay.
It just makes it easier. You know, you recognize where you need to put certain beats, and it just makes everything fucking easier. Like, finally, Some Good News kind of has a three-act structure. And I'm glad, because it certainly needed something to hold it together.
Yeah, like, there's something about that three-act structure that's just, like, totally inherent to... it's so ingrained in the way that humans tell stories that, like, you can try and escape from it, but if you're thinking of a story, it's probably going to have some kind of three-act structure, beginning, a middle, and an end.
I think the Hollywood development way of teaching it is a lot better than the stupid, like, hero's journey graph and, like, Joseph Campbell and all this other horseshit.
That also, I'd say, I've learned through Hollywood is just, for as many of the awful things to do with Hollywood have to do with the fact that it's, you know, entirely commercial, that's also where you can learn some of the most important lessons, is just the raw, you know, way of giving people what they want.
And a great screenplay is a great thing to read. Great dialogue is great to read, and it really pulls you through it a lot faster than trudging through prose. So that's, I think to an extent I kind of learned pacing from screenplays too. Like, I try to make my stuff rip through it, right? And you get that the same feeling as reading a screenplay.
Before we wrap up the show, Tacos, do you have any upcoming projects you want to plug?
Well, I'm working on another novel that's probably not going to be out for 2 years. It's called True Love, and I'm in the very early stages of writing it. So that's going to be the big one. That's finally, Some Good News is a short novel, and this is going to be a longer one and a bigger one. Savage Spear of the Unicorn is still a pretty new book. I don't know. Go to deliciestacos.com. My Twitter is delicious_tacos. If you fucking Google Delicious Tacos, you'll fucking find all my shit. Go read it. And if you like me, then if you're a woman, have sex with me. And if you're a man, give me money.
Delicious Tacos, it's been an excellent show. And check out his work. I'd recommend it.
Thanks.